This is a dialogue. I am not laying down the truth. If I tried to lay down the truth this morning, I would be denying my fundamental contention, which is that no man has a right to lay down the truth. Okay, this is truth. Truth is what she is, far or far. The way we think about reality doesn't make reality. So when it comes to truth, I'm an absolutist. However, I'm also a relativist, because I don't think that any man has a handle on truth. And the most dangerous man and the most misled man is he who claims to have a handle on truth. And if he thinks he has a handle, he doesn't listen to anybody else. We need dialogue with other people if we are to find out what's really out there. So, I have a dialogue with you this morning. What I have to say, I hope it makes sense. And I hope that in the discussion that follows, I do intend to wind up before 9 o'clock, that you will correct my misapprehension. Now, there are basically two opposing positions with respect to the problem of civil disobedience today. One involves loosely a conservative position which says, you've got to obey the law. Every man ought to obey the law, even when he doesn't agree. And the other position says, conscience is always supreme above the law, and you should never obey an unjust law. Now these two positions, I argued on Wednesday, are both correct in what they assert. They're both wrong in what they deny. The first position is correct in asserting that one ought to obey the law even when he disagrees with it. This is essential for any kind of civil order. But the second position is correct in saying that law cannot bind the man's conscience. The man must finally act on his faith. Now the problem for us today is how do we get these two truths together? How are we going to reconcile lack of power that we didn't have, power that we don't have, to hold both of these things simultaneously? One ought to obey the law, even when he disagrees, and at the same time, human conscience judges law, the law cannot bind man's conscience. Our inability to get these things together is threatening our society today with civil war on the one hand, and with repressive tyranny on the other. The trouble is that the threat of civil war feeds repressive tyranny, and repressive tyranny feeds civil war. So we've got to find some way to concede the supremacy, the ultimacy of moral obligation, and at the same time, not destroy our political order. I think if you reflect on it, you'll see that this problem doesn't always arise in society. It only arises when a society lacks moral consensus. See, if there were a moral consensus in our society today, meaning that everyone shared the same fundamental moral viewpoints, that our value judgments were broadly harmonious, congruent, one with another, then our laws would reflect this moral consensus, and a person would never find himself in the position of being pulled one way by law and the other way by moral obligation. The problem only arises when the moral consensus of the society has been shattered, as it has been, obviously, in our society today. Our moral consensus is badly fractured, as evidenced by the number of people who are going about saying, one has a moral obligation. I owe it to God to do such and such. Whereas a large number of people on the other hand are calling that very act demonic, sinful, evil. This is evidence of a deep moral division. We haven't been able to reestablish the consensus. And as I tried to suggest on the fundamental reason we haven't been able to do it is because we have adopted a false philosophy. A philosophy that, in effect, eliminates the concept of moral obligation and substitutes for it something that is superficially similar, but in reality radically different. The notion that a man should act on the basis of his conscience. These are the two different ideas. The concept of That is not the same as the statement, a man must act on the basis of his conscience. Why do I say that? Well, if you reflect for a moment, you will realize that conscience is merely the place where decisions occur. It's the locus of decision. It is not the basis of decision. In other words, conscience is what does the deciding. It is not a valid reason for the decision. Does that call you? I don't know. If I say, I am going to do this because my conscience tells me to, what kind of reason is that? What is my conscience? I mean, I say, I'm going to kill you because my conscience tells me. That is no reason whatsoever. That is no valid reason. How can you argue? I say, the reason is my conscience tells me. What can you say? You don't know what my conscience is doing. That's no reason. That is, I said, the fatal error that we have made. It isn't just an error of speech. It isn't just a way in which the masses have, a way of thinking in which the masses have drifted. I contend that this is part of a whole revolt against reason, the rejection of rationality, the deification of privatism and subjective preference and so on, that is most rapid among the intellectuals of our time. But if you take this point of view seriously, that conscience is the basis for decision, you are led to a radical kind of subjectivism, ethical relativism of the purest sort. It means that in a society of 200 million people, there are 200 million ultimate truths. And this is totally incompatible with the existence of a genuine community. Community means communitas, communion, having in common. This position denies by definition that men can share, can have in common anything ultimate. And then society, a political order of any sort, human cooperation, where these things happen to exist, they all become fortunate accidents. Well, how nice that we happen to agree. Where they do not occur, where we do not agree, we cannot create agreement because we have nothing in common. It is that we each have a separate God, 200 million gods, to which we owe ultimate and unswerving loyalty. Well, such a position, it seems to me, does violence to all human experience. And I don't care how neatly you can get to that conclusion from David Hume, it's wrong. It does violence to human experience. It denies, among other things, our deep and vital sense of common humanity, something that you all sense this morning. You know, doggone it, that the people in this room share with you a common humanity. This is a matter of direct experience. You know that we all share the same world, that this feeling is the same for everyone, no matter how variously we interpret it or even distort it. I mean, I may have astigmatic vision, you may be colorblind. But we say, I have a fault in my vision. We say, I am colorblind. Because we believe that those things are what they are, and they are the same for all of us, even though because of our idiosyncrasies, the emphasis is on the error in itself, we may interpret them variously. We all know, too, we vividly experience the fact that we share a common rationale. This is something that makes communication among us possible. Communication by speech, primarily. You can talk and communicate about the deepest things to a person whom you only met 10 minutes ago. And you can communicate by look, gesture, touch, by a thing we call empathy. Now these, I find, undeniable facts of human experience. This common world, common humanity, common rationality, ability to communicate about these even the most ultimate matters. I cannot believe that a philosophy which does such violence to human experience as to deny all these things can be correct. And therefore, I reject it. And I propose that we put in its place a philosophy that takes as its fundamental premises these two propositions. All men do share a common world. And secondly, all men partake of a common rationality. And by rationality here, I mean in both general sense, the power of grasping, interpreting, systematizing, and talking about the world. All right, if you accept these premises, which I think every one of you does, it follows that whenever two people disagree in a judgment of any sort, both cannot be correct. And it is sheer nonsense to say, well, you're correct and I'm correct. It all depends on your point of view. It doesn't all depend on your point of view. Each may be partially correct, or each may be all totally wrong, of course. I doubt that anyone, I don't want to say that anyone is ever totally wrong. I mean, see why? Because any of them, no matter how off base a person may be, he must have grasped the vision of something out there. If he's wholly wrong, then there's no possibility of leading him toward the common truth. I never like to say that anybody is totally wrong. But obviously, we can disagree in an argument for both of us to be 98% wrong. But most importantly, it follows from these premises that there exists a procedure for correcting erroneous premises. And that procedure is most simply to think again and to look again. When you and I disagree, we can't both be right. How are we going to find out who is right? Not by thought, but by thinking again and looking again. Now what's the guarantee of this problem? That when we look again and think again, we won't just engage in a rote repetition of our previous looking and thinking. Huh? The answer is there is no guarantee. But there is something that we can use to make it unlikely, and that is dialogue. We ask the other person who has seen something different what it is he has seen. We talk to one another. The growth of knowledge is largely the repudiation of error. I think the theorists have learned, and would agree, that we learn not so much by discovering what is true as by discovering what we thought to be true was false. You reflect on that. You know, I recently read an example of a book. A kid was ahead of Siamese cat and blue eyes. Yeah, this kid had a Siamese cat, and for the only cat he'd known, they killed him at a neighbor's cat, who was also a Siamese cat. And one day he was outside on the sidewalk, and one of the Persian cat with yellow eyes. And the kid was just flabbergasted. And he comes running inside and says, "Mother, I saw a cat with yellow eyes." Well, what did he discover? All cats don't have blue eyes. He found out his presupposition, all cats have blue eyes, was an error. And he grew in knowledge in that moment. I think this is usually the way we learn. In fact, learning something new so much as discovering something we previously held to be true is wrong. But we need other people for this. When our judgments, I mean our non-trivial judgments, conflict with those of another person, we must talk. We must compare experience. We have to let thought contend. And then, refreshed by dialogue, we look again and think again. Now, when this activity that I just described takes place within a self-conscious community of specialists focusing on a particular area of the world, we call that procedure scientific method. No one can deny that this method has yielded extraordinary results. Extraordinarily productive of human understanding. Well, I am contending this morning for the use of the same procedure to achieve common understanding in the world of error, in the area of morals and politics. Now, I just want to say, you're applying a scientific method to morals and politics. No, not really. We have done ourselves a gross disservice by allowing scientists exclusively to appropriate this process. Not really. It isn't the scientist's fault, it's our fault. We have neglected to suppose that the scientists have some kind of magic ritual through which they run that leads them to truth. So that when scientists come to the conclusion, you know, by golly, it's true, it happens that way. When scientists says E equals MC squared, he proved it by wiping off Hiroshima. It is not some kind of magic incantation called scientific method that makes science productive of human knowledge and understanding, even when it is used for divine purposes. It is just this process that I've described. The men are committed to the proposition that our world is in common. Some scientist says, I got my own private world. I know you've got your own human genes and chromosomes and all that, but I got mine and don't bug me with your stuff, buddy. I'm in my own little world here. And he's thrown out. He's not an earth scientist. You've got to assume it's going to be a scientist if you share a world in common with other people. And if the guy says, I got my own rules of logic here. I believe in a Hainian logic. You've got to be able to communicate your results to your fellow scientists. Moreover, if you say, it's true, my colleague, but I'm not going to publish my results. Or if you say, somebody publishes the results and somebody criticizes them, and you respond with a nasty letter, you're out of the scientific community too. You know, you've got to be open to criticism. And this is the process which makes men think again and look again, and which leads to the growth of human knowledge. And this process is simply the process of dialogue. The tragedy is that we have refused to use this process in the area of morals and politics, an area that we now tragically consign to irrationality, personal prejudice, and the sheerest Any idiot can make a statement and have it accepted in the area of morals and politics. You know what the word idiot means? It comes from the Greek. The Greek word meaning private, one's own, having nothing to do with anybody else. An idiot, then, is somebody who is completely private. Now, how can we make a beginning of getting ethics, moral, politics back into the area of human dialogue? I think we could begin by altering our language. Let's no longer say, every man must follow his conscience. Let's say instead, every man must do his duty. Why? Well, the word duty carries the essential connotation for which I'm contending. Obligation toward what? Toward reality, toward everything that is, including human beings, and including not only humans, including human skin well. You must act out of obligation toward our common reality. Oh, when I say, I say, I can violate such and such law to my conscience tells me. I have given no reason with which you can agree or disagree. I place my decision beyond dialogue, and thereby I place my actions beyond correction, except by force, of course. But when I say I shall violate such and such a law because I feel it is my duty, then I am asserting an obligation for this common world of ours, and the basis exists for dialogue. When Martin Luther King violated certain laws, he was asserting that those laws were unjust. But he was not saying merely, I think so. That's my private opinion. Martin Luther King wasn't saying, that's my personal, completely subjective preference that those laws are unjust. He was saying to us, read his speeches, look at his strategy above all, the way he actually acted. You discover he was saying to us, look again, think again. I submit that if you look longer and think more deeply, you will come to share my judgment. Now, if we were all free from anxiety, insecurity, guilt, and if every one of us was spontaneously, profoundly sensitive to every nuance of experience, then I believe civil disobedience would never be necessary. Bob. If we were all free from anxiety, insecurity, guilt, hang on. And if we were all profoundly sensitive to every nuanced human experience, civil disobedience wouldn't have been necessary.
Yeah.
But we ain't. We are not all men and women. Very few of us even come close to that idea. Rather, what we do, what I do, what I think you do, seize upon those truths that support us, our kind of world, our kind of people, and then we extend them where they do not apply. We turn partial truths into dogmas. We turn tentative insights into a closed system of thought. In practice, we run around denying our fallibility, our narrowness of vision, our partiality to our own interests. And this is a double problem. You see, we are fallible. We do have narrow vision. We are partial to our own interests, and we compound the sin by denying it in practice. You know, nobody denies it in theory. Nobody says, I'm omniscient. I have never heard. Nobody seriously says it. But in practice, we act as if it were so. We deny our need for dialogue to correct and amplify and deepen our understanding. Our attitude toward anyone who disagrees with us on a matter that profoundly affects us is, who are you to tell me what's right? Don't you feel it? Whenever somebody takes a stand, it really makes a difference to you in your life. Maybe it's because that you believe for years such and such, and you've talked about it. I'll give you a silly example. I think I make a point. A couple of days ago, Lois wrote me. Like they told me that her daughter, Beth, had gone to Image Lake and back in one day. And that's 38 miles round trip, up and down. And I went about half that way in back one day to Cloudy Pass, and I was dead in 2 days. And I just said it was impossible. And it turned out to be cat. She'd only gone to line, which is still back in one day for every beast. But then I was discussing again the next day with somebody, and we not only found that the best brokering had not done it, but that it was impossible to do it. That same day, 4 people in the village did. Original sin is what makes democracy difficult and also what makes it necessary. Well, now, I seem to have digressed from the question of civil disobedience, but not really. Let me come back to it very quickly. Can we sanction disobedience to law? My answer would have to be yes, as a form of political dialogue, as a continuation of dialogue, where dialogue is still necessary but has ceased. Dialogue is still necessary in a society wherever moral consensus does not yet exist. Wherever some are willing to accept what others call intolerable injustice. Clearly, when you have such a situation, you do not have moral consensus. But when dialogue has ceased, when one side, or perhaps both sides, are resting content in their own virtue and have shut off the other side, don't bother me with your what you think and what you experience, and don't give me your arguments. My God, these are the conclusions upon which I base my facts. When we come to that point, then disobedience to law may be necessary to reopen the dialogue, to compel people to hear. Let me put a personal note here, because it's makes the point. I have made financial contributions to SDS and have in very small ways contributed toward SDS's quote educational activity. I'm not a member of SDS. I do not agree with SDS. But I support them because I find that the branch that I support is engaging in moral discourse. That it is expressing in a challenging and provocative way the moral concerns of many people, especially many younger people in our society, who would find the utility of the SDS. It is the SDS, largely by its tactics, its courage, its willingness to risk, its extremism, is blasting open a discussion in several areas that has been foreclosed. Now, I support the SDS. I'm not supporting all the law violations of the SDS and everything that the SDS does. But the SDS, I think it could be demonstrated, has prompted some new looking and some new thinking in our society, partially out of fear. Many people can only be jarred into new looking and new thinking by fear. And some of the militant extremist groups in our society are doing it. As I say, I support the SDS in fear and trembling, because I do not agree with many of their conclusions, and because we're, what I'm interested in is not the conclusions of the SDS, but the process, which I think they are promoting. But I'm also in fear and trembling, because the SDS shares the original human sin, and they are often shockingly unaware. But while I support them, I also engage in arguments with moral discourse with my friends in the SDS. I'm learning from them, but I hope that I have something both true about them also to communicate to them. Let me just conclude this application. I'm three suggestions for reflection and discussion and for order. Number one, civil disobedience is not a weapon to use frivolously to support ego trips or for trivial causes. It must be exercised in obedience to duty, to moral obligation. And our moral obligations extend in many directions simultaneously. The dissident still has an obligation to the social order, even when he decides he must disrupt that order in obedience to a more urgent and commanding duty. Second observation. Governments will attempt to punish those who engage in acts of civil disobedience. That's all the nature of the government, you might say, or the powers of the same nature of the beast. It's to be expected. But conviction and imprisonment do not establish that a man is wrong, only that he violated the law. But it was his contention that the law is wrong. And we must continue listening to him even when we imprison him. Perhaps Dr. Spock should be jailed. I'm not confident to say. But Dr. Spock is not in silence. He should not be subjected, as he has been, to the disparagement and the vilification that I've seen in many quarters. People aren't reading his baby book anymore. It's amazing how people who worship Dr. Spock before his arrest and conviction, since his arrest and conviction, have nothing but the worst sort of things to say about him. Why should we not silence him? Because he is a man who is attempting to speak to us. Above all, because he's a man who has taken his moral obligation toward us so seriously that he has risked jail to break through and make us hear. Can we not even have the courage to listen to him? Remember, to learn from those who disagree with us, learning is the exposure of error. We need dialogue because we are fallible. He who disagrees profoundly with the topic most needs to hear. Third option. Dialogue is not always verbal or merely verbal. There are indicated acts of law violation can be dialogue, or at least an essential prelude to dialogue. Again, converting to Dr. Martin Luther King, he always, if you look at his strategy, his counsel and move in, he always said, first said, let's sit down and talk. Only when the leadership of the community would not talk would he engage in an act of civil disobedience. And he was always willing to stop it as soon as they would start to talk. But now, the same thing has to be said for other forms of nonverbal dialogue. For example, hairstyles and clothing style. Now, I'm going to say in advance, I wear a beard because I don't like to shave, my wife likes to be. I am saying nothing about my position on any issue by wearing a beard, really. There was a survey I got recently that the Bad Magazine Intelligence Incorporated conducted for CBS on the Generation of Parks series. It was on youth attitudes today. And one of the most interesting pieces of information in there was adults were asked in this survey, what is it that would most bother you about youth today? And they were allowed free response. Guess what topped the list? Grooming and appearance. Well, is that silly? No, it's not. It's not. Many of the young people who are wearing long hair and beads and granny glasses are saying something thereby to us that we don't like. It's a subtle sort of message, and they may not even know exactly what it is. Although I think they have an interest. But we know what it is, or we wouldn't get so damn mad. They are suggesting in some way that our values are out of kilter, that our lives have lost their focus, that our smugness and self-satisfaction are not justified. At least that is what I hear them say. And it bugs me. I'm a fairly complacent middle-class college teacher. But when we react as we do, with anger and exasperation to such a gentle form of aggression, it seems to me we are asking the violence to explode. If your kid comes home with long hair and beads, listen to it. I don't mean to say, no. All right, tell me why you're wearing this. Including operations, I will have a parallel vision. restore the moral consensus in America, to preserve the integrity of the individual today, and simultaneously to maintain the social order, we've got to talk to one another, earnestly, honestly, especially with those who reject our values. Well, will this kind of dialogue be fruitful? Will it be worthwhile? It will not be worthwhile if the irrational are right, and value judgments are nothing but subjective preferences, your personal prejudices, private things, and caprices. Then there's really nothing to talk about and nobody worth talking to. But if you believe that every value judgment is finally a judgment about the world, and that all men share the same world, and that all men participate in a common rationality which makes it possible for them to communicate to one another their insights and convictions, then you will engage in moral discourse, and you will find it enough. Okay. We've got 20 minutes. Yes, sir.
Well, so far it seems to me that what you've done is demolished one way of figuring out what our duty is, anyway. But this would seem to leave open the question, obviously, of what means we might employ to establish what our duty is. And it seems to me if one starts following out that issue or that question, the whole problem of whether or not we really do share a common world seems to arise. I mean, some people perhaps might appeal to the will of God as determining what their duty is, the Ten Commandments, and the rest of the law. But others, like Martin Luther King, might appeal to natural law, which itself is very vague and misunderstood. I mean, how exactly do we move in this direction? And it seems to me, perhaps, because of Lutherans themselves are going to share a kind of
thing. Yeah, very, very good question. King, I don't think King's rhetoric when he was talking about the natural law was adamant to his own thought. King did, when King talked about natural law, and I looked at some of his texts very, very carefully to see now what did he really assert? What does it come out? He was asserting something like what I said. He was saying, look, I don't know if you believe in natural law or the color of the big end or small end. What I'm saying is, you Americans, you know, by golly, if you'll just think about it and look around, look at the consequences of this discrimination. You look at it, you really look at it and let it enter into you, you will reject it too. Now, the problem I'm afraid, I kind of dislike natural law. And I dislike, in the political realm, appeals to the Ten Commandments, precisely because these are excuses for not looking at experience and not listening to other people. I'm not rejecting the Ten Commandments. I'm rejecting our misuse of them. So I kind of make a position, look, use principle if you want. Like if you want to say, look, the Ten Commandments are a good guide to life. Okay. But if somebody challenges, meet him on his own ground. Because, as Luther rather neatly points out, man is capable of making the Ten Commandments or the natural law or the orders of creation or anything he wants to make them out to be. We can always justify what we're determined to justify. So, what we've got to do, I think, is and by the way, I want to say the conscience, how did you put the further way on? We decide with our conscience, of course. We've got to use our conscience. I mean, I don't know what conscience is. It seems to me conscience is another name for the individual and the patient. I mean, keep the thing together. That's it. But you decide. There's an inner decision. But you decide on the basis of outer evidence. I mean, you don't want to do something, you say, for example, people argue about the Vietnam War. They're not arguing about their consciences. They're arguing about the consequences of military actions. And this is something that one can talk about. If we keep talking, is that the question? Sure.
Paul, I think that but the term that you use, or that is commonly used, is civil disobedience, does not accurately describe the type of action that you're talking about. I mean, civil disobedience is if you have a Chevrolet dealer that sells a Chevrolet and the wheel falls off on the way home. You've now disobeyed a civil relationship between people. And what we've been talking about today is a violation of a state law, and a violation of that is a crime. And so what we're talking about is a criminal disobedience. That doesn't make it any worse or any better. It falls now within a certain category. And in order to get the dialogue going within the confines which is recognized by the people of our state, a disobedience is necessary, or else they don't have anything to talk about. You've got to violate or allegedly violate the law in order to bring it into the legal system, in order that dialogue then follows. So the state expects to hear disobedience of their criminal statute.
Yeah, Gary is a lawyer. He's out that we can have civil actions and criminal actions, but I don't think most people here are aware of that. The term civil disobedience is the term that is used, I think, to describe the kinds of activities in which Martin Luther King engaged.
I was thinking that people would understand the term and get their feeling for it if they said, all right, we're going to commit a crime.
Jerry, for you, a crime is a very specific. For you, a man can, because you're a lawyer and you know what this means, your man can commit a crime and you don't hold it against him at all because he's trying to test the law. But for most people in here, to commit a crime, and that prejudges the issue. If I were to ask the question, are you ever justified in committing a crime? We would all, no. Because by crime, we mean acts that you're never justified in committing, don't we? I mean, when we say it, that's a crime.
Well, so we asked the people who came up with the phrase civil disobedience, just went through the same thought process we did, and probably rejected because no other justification could do with criminal. I think 100% right, but if I were on the other side of the fence and I was looking for a handbook to look at, to the label, and wanted to know what my actions were, I would have said probably my method still this would be, you know. I think the people who are involved in this movement, I don't think it was an accident that they came up civil disobedience. That sounds great. That sounds like the slave revolting on the streets or something. They call yourself criminals, they might know that term is real well. Let me ask you this, though. I wonder whether or not in this country you believe we've ever had a singular or almost singular a moral consensus. Before you answer, my theory is we've always had a multiple moral consensus on so maybe Brown versus Board of Education in 54, or in that period, this country has never had a singular purpose. And this is why we're having all this trouble. We've been sectionalized, south, east, west, midwest, economically, transportation, all business. Now all of a sudden after the war, the Second World War, the new thought and law and philosophy, somebody's told us we're all one country, and we've never had a country for 100 years. And this lifetime, the total process is difficult. And we're interested about this, discussing it with you, and we found anybody to ever indicate that might be true or not.
The best thing that I've heard on the discussion is Daniel Boyce, the genius of American politics, where he was kind of supporting the funds of living. He argues that we have never really had a conscious moral consensus because we've never had a political philosophy because we've never needed one. we were part of the munificence of our surroundings and in part due to the peculiar facts of our history that enable us to function as if we had a consensus, when in truth we never demanded the question. But as soon as the question became acute, the Civil War, boom, blew apart. But then we managed to repair it by going back to the old traditional way. I don't want to get into it. It's not a very long book. Of course, we wrote this book in 1952. I think it's most interesting to read it today and see policy, irrelevant to the contemporary situation we're creating. I don't know if this is responsive to your
question. It's responsive to the question. I have to be one of the basic premises values in my thought process.
Yeah, you mean, if a society can have, you kind of agree with a multi-purpose society, but these purposes were all conflict. They didn't come into ultimate conflict.
They didn't come into conflict because there was no environment to come into conflict. That's the
same thing.
The people, we had all the Negroes in the South, okay?
Yes.
The people really didn't care too much about how they were treated in the South. So we got, if you look at the expansion of transportation after the Second World War, bus routes, a whole different, and money flowing over here. Did people get on a bus or an automobile? You know, 1937 or 38, I'm told, from what I read, anybody didn't have a car. And sure, everybody didn't have two cars. But now I can hire some of you if you're 3 years old, and you would bring 90 people to Chicago and do it by 1,000 people per day. And then all of a sudden, what they did in the South, what they had been doing in the South, made a difference in Chicago, where it really had never made a difference. The Eastern money, for instance, just talking about building homes. Eastern money was flowing around on that side of the mountain for a long time, and finally got into the Midwest, and in that last few years, out of